Hi everyone, I'm Stephanie, a mom to a Mito fighter. On our podcast, Energy in Action, we talk all things Mito, and I'm glad you're here to learn and to be part of our community. I'd like to welcome everyone back to this week's episode of Energy in Action. I'm your host, Stephanie, and here on Energy in Action, we talk all things Mito and rare disease, and I am very excited for you to hear our next guest.
Welcome to today's episode of Energy in Action. We are excited to have with us Richard Ellis, Director of Patient Advocacy and Industry Engagement with All Stripes, and Chad Glasser, Director of Clinical Research with Cyclerion Therapeutics. Today, we're going to talk about a pivotal clinical trial that Cyclerion Therapeutics has for MELAS and the partnership and collaboration that we have with All Stripes in order to help move this research initiative forward. Chad, do you want to start off and just tell us a little bit about the MELAS study that is currently enrolling for Cyclerion?
Sure. As you said, we have an ongoing clinical study in patients with MELAS that is evaluating our investigational drug 6463. This is a, I think, comparatively short clinical study in that it's 29 days in duration. We're looking at safety and tolerability primarily. That's the primary endpoint of the trial. But we're also interested in determining what 6463 is doing to the disease. And so we have a range of other exploratory biomarkers. We have a few questionnaires that we're asking patients to respond to that evaluate biomarkers such as lactate, which is quite relevant for this indication, as well as other biomarkers of neural inflammation, biomarkers of changes in blood perfusion in the brain using neuroimaging, and also just general improvements in cognition. So we see this as a signal-seeking study and an opportunity to learn as much as we can about the molecule. It's a 12-patient study. We're aiming to enroll up to 12 patients, and we know that following this trial, we'll have to obviously conduct larger and longer patient studies per regulatory requests and need to prove efficacy. But this is our way of learning about the indication and learning about our molecule.
That's great. Can you tell us at what point in the study IW6463 currently is?
In terms of development?
Yeah. You know, for a lot of our listeners, the clinical trial process is a new process. And so understanding when we talk about, you know, the different phases of clinical trials, enrollment. So where can you explain where in the process of the clinical trial spectrum that this study currently is? And then what will be the next steps beyond the current phase?
Sure. We're calling this a phase 2A study, meaning it's kind of an abbreviated phase 2 study. And when we talk about phase 2 studies in terms of drug development, it's typically a patient study. We've conducted a couple phase 1 studies. Those were conducted in healthy volunteers. So we established safety, tolerability. We looked at drug concentrations just to make sure that our dose was right. And now we're obviously in a patient trial. So this study has been open and enrolling a fairly long period of time. And I think that's one of the reasons that we want to have these outreach sessions where we can talk about the trial, because we are actively looking for participants. We have 5 sites that are enrolling that are located in the Northeast, and we are looking to have patients as soon as possible to move this research along. In terms of what happens after this, as I kind of alluded to earlier, there are subsequent confirmatory studies that need to be conducted, considering this is a small kind of early phase exploratory study, our first study in patients. So following this, we would need to further confirm safety and efficacy based on, you know, regulatory discussions that we would have with the agency, and then obviously move hopefully closer and closer to an eventual approval.
Right. That's exciting. You explained to our listeners the importance of patient participation in clinical trials and why having these conversations and sharing this information with our community so that they're aware that these trials are taking place. Why is it so important for our community to understand that this is going on and for them to take an active role to understand whether they qualify and to engage to participate in a clinical trial?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple answer. I mean, we can't get drugs approved and evaluate safety and efficacy of any investigational drug without patient engagement and willingness to get involved. We have a responsibility to study these drugs in a sufficient number of patients, as I said, to fully understand what it's doing. And that is how we justify approval. And that's how we move from one phase to the next. And like I said, we have had enrollment challenges. We've tried to reach patients along the way, and it has been challenging. I think the pandemic has obviously created a lot lot of challenges, you know, just getting to and from clinics and participating in these types of trials and doing the study visits have been a challenge. And so we've implemented a number of ways to make it easier for patients where we're providing travel reimbursements. We're helping schedule a lot of the visits using kind of a centralized concierge service. We also allow remote visits. I mean, we understand that these trials can be very time consuming and are a big sacrifice for patients to get involved, but it's really, really, really important for us. Like I said, we can't move forward unless patients are willing to offer themselves up to these types of studies.
Absolutely. And I think for a lot of patients, some of the hesitancy comes with not understanding the safety. So can you talk a little bit about, for patients, what would you want potential patients to understand about the safety in them participating in a clinical trial like this one?
I think that's a big question we get. I mean, I think most patients don't want to feel like they're a guinea pig and that there's a high risk of getting involved in an early phase study like this. Like I said, this is a first inpatient study. However, again, per regulatory guidelines, you know, before you move into a clinical study and before you give a investigational drug to a human, healthy or not, there needs to be a set of animal studies and tox studies, looking at various dose levels, looking at various durations before you can justify moving into the clinic. So we've, of course, done all of those studies. We fully understand our molecule and our mechanism, and we have conducted 2 phase 1 studies, as I mentioned earlier, in healthy volunteers. We know kind of the dose range. We know the adverse event profile, which is minimal to date, and we feel very confident in the safety profile and kind of the risk-benefit ratio of moving into patients. Studies. And this is something that is part of the consent process. It's something that will be covered with the patient at the site by the investigator and the study personnel. And any of those adverse events that have been found to date for any molecule will be communicated so the patient can make a very well-educated decision about whether to participate. Specifically for 6463, I think we've dosed over 110 people already. Again, these were healthy volunteers, but we still have yet to find something, you know, a red flag or a safety signal that would inhibit our ability to move forward. So we feel quite confident in the safety profile of the drug to date, and it's very well characterized. So hopefully patients don't feel like they're going to be a guinea pig if they were to sign up for this trial.
Absolutely. So you talked about if there are possible adverse effects, those are communicated to the trial participants. Would a participant at any time have the opportunity to remove themselves from participating in the trial if they no longer felt comfortable?
Absolutely, yes. That's a core part of clinical research and the consenting process. To do anything to a patient at that very first contact with the site, they need to provide consent. And that consent can be withdrawn at any point in time for whatever reason. So it's absolutely up to the patient to determine how long they want to participate, you know, reasons that they want to or don't want to. That's totally up to the patient to decide that.
That's really great. And again, you know, the patient voice matters. And I know that you guys work really hard to always give the patient an opportunity to take an active role and have a voice and to share information and to share feedback. So this is just another opportunity where they're allowed to do that within this process, which is really, really important for our community to understand. So I'm a patient that has a clinical or genetic diagnosis with MELAS. What does or doesn't qualify me to participate in this particular trial?
Great question. So in terms of qualifying, so things that you need to have, as you mentioned, there needs to be some sort of genetic confirmation of a mitochondrial disease mutation. And I think one of the things that is known in the mito community is that there's a disconnect between a genetic diagnosis and also kind of a clinical diagnosis, often what's called a phenotype, right? And so patients that have a MELAS mutation don't necessarily have the MELAS clinical phenotype. And so for our trial, we are trying to confirm that they have both because, you know, it's a fairly small study and we want to ensure that the patients we are enrolling have active disease and that we're able to show some sort of effects on that disease. So they need to have genetic confirmation and they need to have some clinical neurological features associated with MELAS. So these are things like stroke-like episodes, of course, which is a core aspect of the diagnosis, can be cognitive impairment, can be just general brain fog, which we know is relevant in MELAS as well as across a range of mitochondrial diseases, severe migraines, headaches, it could be focal seizures, things of that sort. So the eligibility criteria is fairly broad in that sense. And so we often end up discussing patients individually with sites as to whether they would be eligible. So you have to have the genetic confirmation and also some clinical diagnosis as well. And then the other aspect is that you need to be an adult. Currently, our age cutoff is 18 years of age and older. And then we do have kind of a final check that there is active disease. And to do that, we are requiring a certain concentration of lactate to be measured in the plasma during the screening visits. And it's quite common if patients are having those sort of symptoms, those neurological features, that they would also have elevated levels of lactate. But this is just a kind of a double check to ensure that we're enrolling the right patients in our study.
You mentioned a little bit about COVID, and right, it's absolutely caused hesitation for a lot of patients to step forward and want to participate in clinical trials. Issues of safety, issues of getting exposed, going into hospitals and things. So can you talk a little bit about if a patient is accepted into the trial, what does that process look like? And then again, what are some of those additional steps that Cyclerion and the sites are taking to ensure patient safety and accommodating with this crazy world that we're living in right now?
Right. So you can't get around your screening visit, right? The patient will have to come into the clinic, determine whether they're eligible for the trial. So, you know, that's a visit where they'll ask the patient about the medical history, take some baseline labs and determine whether they're qualified. And that can happen anywhere from 28 days before what we would consider day one, which would be the first dose of study drug. If they are considered eligible for the trial, then they would come back into the clinic for that first dose on day one. And then they would be discharged to go home, and they can actually complete that full 29 days at home. And 6463 is an oral therapy. It's taken once daily by mouth. So they'll be given a diary so they can record how they feel and any other medications they're taking, and also for us to monitor compliance of the medication. So within that 29-day period, there are two check-ins, one check-in at week one and one check-in at week two. And now, as you said, obviously there's a lot of hesitancy to come back and forth from home and into a healthcare facility during these times. And we built in, even before COVID, the ability for these visits to occur at home. And so we've hired or contracted with a nursing group that can send a visit, or a nurse that can come and visit the patient in their home, do the assessments that are required per the study, and then that can be shared with the site, and they don't have to actually come to the clinic for those two visits. At the end of that 29-day treatment period, they will have to come back in to do kind of all the end-of-treatment assessments on that day 29 visit. And then there's a follow-up visit, which is 14 days after that 29-day visit, and that can also be done at home. So you're looking at three visits max, as long as patients are comfortable with the at-home nursing visits. In terms of the procedures that we would be doing in the study, I think that's one of the key questions that we get. What are we subjecting patients to? Like I said, for eligibility, there are just standard baseline labs and assessments that we'll do, things like vital sign measurements, you know, measuring your blood pressure, looking at heart rate, respiratory rate. We'll take some labs, you know, standard metabolic labs, and we'll continue to do some blood draws throughout the study to look at both biomarkers that are related to disease, which I mentioned earlier, and also to measure concentrations of our drug over the course of the study. I mentioned that there are some brain imaging that's done. I think one of the more interesting parts of the study is that we are having subjects go through an MRI procedure, because this is a CNS penetrant molecule and it's modulating a pathway in the brain. And so we're looking to see if we're seeing improvements in blood flow in the brain and brain activity, and also if we're seeing improvements in some concentrations of metabolites such as lactate in the brain and various parts of the brain. So that's one of the key procedures that we'll do both at predose and also at the end of treatment. And then I also mentioned some questionnaires. We're interested in what this drug can do to a patient's cognitive function. And we have data to support that our drug and our mechanism can improve neuronal function and cognitive processing. So we're going to ask that patients complete some questionnaires that ask how their cognition has changed over time and how their fatigue levels have also changed over time. The only other thing that I'll mention is that we have included from the beginning, it's called a CSF sample, a cerebral spinal fluid sample. And this is collected via lumbar puncture, which is a procedure where a needle is inserted between two vertebrae in the lower back, and a sample of that fluid is withdrawn. And this is actually very important for us because it allows us to measure concentrations of our drug in the CNS. And as I said, this is really the site of action. So it helps us understand whether we're achieving those concentrations that are associated with efficacy. We have since made that an optional procedure or an opt-out procedure because we realized that this was oftentimes one of the sole reasons that patients don't want to participate. So I'm mentioning it because we do encourage patients to consent to that procedure. It's just one time at the end of treatment because it's important for us scientifically, but we don't want it to be the reason that patients don't sign up for the trial. So there is the opportunity to opt out if that's the sole reason that someone is not wanting to participate.
Okay, that's good to know so that people have choices. You have choices in how extensively you want to get involved. You talked about the neurological cognitive benefits and fatigue, right? Because what patients will want to know is you have all the science behind what's happening as a result of taking the therapy. But what patients will want to know is, what do you expect it will, how will it make me feel different? How will this potentially improve my quality of life?
Yeah, that's tough. So I can speak to what we know about our molecule, and I guess we haven't really talked too much about the mechanism itself. So as I said, it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is a kind of a unique drug aspect. Not all molecules are able to do that. So when we talk about 6463, we do say that it's CNS penetrant because it's targeting the CNS. Once it gets into the CNS, it modulates a signaling pathway that's very, very well studied and well known, well characterized for many years called the nitric oxide pathway. And this is really the first molecule that is able to target this pathway in the CNS. It's been targeted for a number of other indications. There's drugs that are approved to date that have successfully modulated this pathway, but again, not necessarily in the CNS. What we know from animal studies that we've conducted to date and just general knowledge of the pathway is that when we modulate this pathway, we can improve blood flow in the brain, we can improve nerve function, we can also improve cellular bioenergetics, which is kind of a fancier way of saying energy production or mitochondrial function. And we know that all of these things are linked to the clinical manifestations of MELAS. So what that means clinically and what we expect it to do clinically is actually what we're trying to measure in this trial. And so that's why we have these assessments of cognitive function. That's why we have the brain imaging that's being done. And all of these kind of pathologies or origins of disease do give rise to some of those symptoms that we talked about that are needed for inclusion into the trial. So we believe that by modulating this pathway, we could impact, you know, cognitive impairment. We could impact headaches, migraines, stroke-like episodes. This study isn't necessarily designed to evaluate those specific symptoms because it's such a short, small study, but those are all things that we will continue to evaluate, hopefully in subsequent larger and longer studies. But like I said, in this trial specifically, we're looking at biomarkers that are related to those manifestations of disease. And if those move, we believe that that would give us confidence that we could impact those clinical symptoms in a future study.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, for the MELAS community, the potential to have those significant challenges alleviated at any level is a huge step forward for this community. And so we're really excited about the potential of what this trial could mean for the MELAS community. So if you have a patient who is interested in participating, I'm going to share real quickly the sites that are currently enrolling. We've got Children's National Hospital of DC, Johns Hopkins University, Mass General Hospital, Columbia University, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Everything's based on the East Coast. If we have patients that are interested in learning more and getting more information about whether they might qualify for this trial, what are your best suggestions for them getting more details?
We will actually, I believe we're going to post some additional information on the website following this that'll be linked to the podcast. Clinicaltrials.gov is usually the first place that we send patients because it has a lot of details about the study and eligibility criteria, what you can expect in terms of the duration, things that I've already kind of discussed. That's usually the best place to start. And there's also a contact information on the clinicaltrials.gov website for Cyclerion as well. If there are further questions, we can also address those.
Yeah, and we will have all of the site information on the MitoAction website under our clinical trial section. And we will also post everything in the show notes for this podcast episode so that everyone can access that information. And just to clarify, so if I'm a patient and I'm being seen by a physician that is not necessarily one of the investigators at these sites, is it necessary for my physician, right? You, in order to have a genetic testing done, your doctor has to order the test. Is it necessary for your physician to get involved and to recommend you, or can a patient just on their own call and reach out to the study coordinator?
Either way, we always encourage patients to you know, discuss with their physicians any sort of questions about clinical studies.
Okay, that's wonderful. And then, you know, just along the idea of patient empowerment and having a seat at the table in clinical trial development, can you talk a little bit about the results and the reporting that patients who participate in the trial will have access to see? When is that information shared? Is it shared when the general public gets that information? Or how are the trial progress and some of the preliminary results, are those shared with participants as you move through the trial?
Currently, I think everything would be communicated at the same time in terms of externally, in terms of the results of the trial. That would be communicated to external parties and also to just the general patient community, obviously, including patients that were involved in the clinical study. Patient level data and kind of response and results, we would have to talk more about that internally. I'm not quite sure that that's our current plan, but I fully support patients having access to their individual patient level data, especially in a clinical trial of this sort.
Yeah, and we will be excited to share those results with the community as well. I think across the board, clinical trials have struggled with enrollment, especially during COVID. So if you could take a minute and speak to patients that you know would qualify and could potentially benefit from this therapy, what is it that you would want them to know to put them at ease, to help them in their decision to move forward with participating?
That's a great question. So I think we've talked about some of it. I think the first point is that we know a lot about this molecule, and that this is not an extremely exploratory study or an exploratory mechanism. It's very well characterized, and we feel quite confident in the safety profile and the potential efficacy with this mechanism. The second part is that this study has been designed to hopefully be as feasible as possible and as easy for patients to get involved, provided that, you know, they do qualify based on our eligibility criteria. So like I said, things like remote visits, travel reimbursement. If you do live in a state that is farther away from the Northeast, unfortunately, as we said, our sites are concentrated in the Northeast right now. We encourage you to reach out to those sites, and we will compensate and reimburse for travel and hotel stays. And we're trying to make it as flexible and as easy for patients and families, so it's not a huge sacrifice. And then I think the other thing that I just want to really stress is the urgency of this type of work. I think there's not a lot of precedent for studies in MELOS. And so we are trying to learn as we go and pave the way as kind of a pharma-sponsored study and how these initiatives move forward. And so it's not only just a learning experience for us, but we're hoping that it's a way to increase additional confidence for other therapies that could be explored in this indication. So we're hoping that it paves the way for additional trials.
Yeah, and we are so grateful to Cyclerion and your commitment to the MIDO community and stepping forward and making this commitment to move this trial forward and to work with our community and our patient advocacy organizations to share this information with the community, answer any questions so that we can ease any concerns that patients might have so that we can get those 12 patients registered. And it's amazing that, you know, just with 12 patients, you have the ability to move a therapy forward like this. But that's the rare disease space, right? We have so few patients compared to other, you know, larger diseases. And so every single patient participating is so meaningful and truly makes a significant impact into moving these trials forward. So we really appreciate it. Let's bring Rich into the conversation and talk about, you know, it takes all of us, right? No one organization, no one group can move this process forward and bring therapies to market. It takes all of us. And so MIDO Action is really excited to not only work with our pharma partners, but to collaborate with organizations like All Stripes that bring another element to the clinical trial piece and research. So Rich, can you tell us a little bit about what All Stripes does and how the work that you do complements the work that a pharmaceutical company like Cyclerion is doing?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. And we're so appreciative of the work that Mito Action is doing and Chad and his team at Cyclerion are doing. Our mission at All Stripes is to unlock new treatments for people affected by rare disease. And knowing that the one who is diagnosed is not just the one who is affected, it's patients, families, caregivers, the entire community. We're pushing to unlock new treatments for the entire community across the entire rare disease network. And how we're doing that is by introducing a two-sided platform that allows patients to access all of their medical records in one place while also enabling the generation of de-identified data from the community to power new treatment research from home. Essentially, we're seeking to empower patients to contribute without really having to do a ton. And of the multitude of asks that are being made of the patient community, we hope to limit that lift at absolutely no cost. So they're able to feel empowered and inspired to contribute to research while also having a place to advocate for themselves, to share their stories and inspire others to do that. So I think it's sort of a multidimensional approach that includes data contribute to research. The ownership of patient data does lie with the patient. So we want to make sure that we acknowledge that as well. And then also the ability to turn around and share your story where comfortable. And one of the things that All Stripes absolutely deeply connects with in Mito Action's mission is being a storyteller and making sure that your journey, your diagnostic odyssey is shared with the community. So how we're partnering with companies like Cyclerion are to gather data that are reported by healthcare facilities, hospitals, different organizations, and create a data set that is usable for things like clinical trial protocol writing, natural history studies, comparator arm studies, a multitude of different possibilities to make sure that we're widening the window for treatment. And as we talk more about getting patients involved and patients empowered in the process, the most important part is to acknowledge that patients should never feel alone and left out of the drug development, treatment development, advocacy process. This is a way for us to continue to involve patients, families, and caregivers in the management of their own journey, whether that's sharing their story or contributing to research.
Absolutely. And we are honored to be able to expand our role in the clinical trial space and therapy development by working with our pharma partners and partners like All Stripes, so that we can ensure that our patients do have a seat at the table. And as you said, Rich, they're empowered and they're taking an active and meaningful role from the very beginning, even before trials go live. So we are really excited that we have our MELOS initiative with All Stripes, where we are trying to recruit patients who have MELOS, and All Stripes will then help them gather their medical records. And Rich, talk about what that process looks like, the information that is gathered on behalf of the patients, and how that information potentially can help in the Cyclerion clinical trial and moving other clinical trials forward, having that data.
Of course. And the first thing is collecting the data. We have to know the answers because they do lie in the data. So the most important part about involving patients is making sure that they understand the process and what goes into developing programs like the one that Cyclerion is, along with a multitude of others. So that begins with gathering data. So with the consent of patients, families, caregivers, we are able to, on their behalf, at absolutely no cost to them, collect their records that have been stored and reported by healthcare facilities, meaning that we're able to separate both patient-reported outcomes from healthcare-reported outcomes to ensure that data is attractive and made available for research in a way that is FDA audit trailed and ready for usage in a number of different programs. So that process starts with a consent by patients to make sure that they're understanding what being a part of de-identified research is. It's then the ability for us to go and collect records on their behalf. And then the tactical side of that starts when we're able to be pointed in the direction of the facilities and the different places and specialists that patients have visited in the past. So simply put, our team knows where to go to find, collect, and digitize those records to place them in the portal for each patient. So that's sort of where the process starts. And, you know, I'd love to get into more of it.
So really from the patient perspective, all they need to do is go to the All Stripes website. They need to give consent, and then All Stripes takes it from there, correct?
Absolutely. We have programs across the Mito community, and specifically for the MELOS patients, it takes about 10 or 15 minutes to sign up from start to finish, indicate which facilities and specialists you've seen, and the team will take it over from there to make sure that your records are securely placed in one place. And I want to make sure that we do put an emphasis on the security and data side of the management so that patients know that they can trust that this portal is secure. It is a safe place for their medical records to live, and also for forward-facing usage, where they're able to download and take these records off the platform. And one of the things that we recognize with a lot of rare disease communities is that folks are taking around the large care binders. And we've seen patients across 5 or 6 decades, particularly within the Mito community, where the records are extensive. And they have binders and binders that they're taking to new specialists, or when answering the question, what has happened in over the last few months or even years from visit to visit, depending on where they are. This is a really modern take on a way to manage that process without having to lug these giant binders to make sure that they're getting the care they need and that they deserve.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually had one family share with us that they carry a wagon with them to their appointments because they have so many binders filled with all of this documentation. And I think, you know, what's really important for us to share about what AllStripes does is beyond just collecting the data, right? Because our patients have the binders. They've got all of the binders with all of the copies. But you guys take it even further, and you have an incredible team of clinicians and data analysts and genetic counselors and researchers who then take the information that's in the medical records and you translate that into usable data. Can you share a little bit about what that is and the value that that brings? So beyond just the collection of the records, then taking that information and translating it into something of incredible value.
Yeah, and I appreciate you recognizing the work that the researchers and the abstraction teams are doing, because it is so, so critical to not only producing research that comes from within AllStripes, but also making it available to collaborate. So once these records are collected and a patient is signed up through the process and consent remains in place to use their de-identified medical records, our team will then design a protocol for data abstraction, meaning that they're looking for meaningful points specific to each condition. And as we all know, every rare disease is different, and every patient's records within each rare condition in different patient communities is different, and a journey that we have to treat as an individual odyssey. So as our team comes together and designs what they're pulling from the medical records to create a data set that is attractive to researchers and will draw interest for collaboration and from companies like Cyclerion, the goal is to understand that what is the base level of data here we're pulling, and then also what is condition specific. So we have a team of researchers that are trained and are excellent at isolating the needs of the community, particularly within the mitochondrial space, to know what is needed to conduct research, but then also what are they doing? What are they compiling from an abstraction perspective to do research on our own? So it's not just about finding collaboration, although, of course, that is the most important part. But being able to utilize the records from the second that they're collected adds value to the patient experience and can be given back to the community in the form of research insights and information that can be turned into advocacy work and education for the general public. So it's sort of both an internal and external facing initiative that we're incredibly proud of. And personally, I'm incredibly proud of our team.
Absolutely. And we are excited to partner with AllStripes, and we look forward to all of the great things that are to come and that we're looking to do with your organization and your team. And then, Rich, let's talk about, so now I've collected all of this, and you know, you guys have collected the data, you've collected my records, you've done these evaluations. But even one step further, then you also provide opportunities for patients to be connected with clinical trials based on their diagnoses. So can you share a little bit about how that piece works and the information that is provided within your platform that gives the community access to information about trials that might be relevant to their diagnosis?
Of course. And I think that we've all outlined how important it is that we're all moving in the same direction toward the common goal of unlocking new treatments within this community. So one of the things that is so important to us is providing patients with resources, not just on the education side, but for ways to get involved with teams like Chad's team at Cyclerion that are actively seeking participants in clinical trials who can help move the needle in terms of treatment options available to patients. So on our platform and within our community, we're able to provide a constantly updated list of clinical trials with information and the ability to indicate interest to receive more information in a pointed direction toward ways to make more of an impact. I think one of the things that we've outlined pretty well today is that there's a multitude of ways that patients, families, caregivers can impact the progress of the community in terms of developing new treatments. And whether that's just taking one step to own their medical records or wanting to contribute to research from home or simply wanting to actively get involved in the clinical trial process, we owe that to the patient community as we continue to develop records. And so on the platform, a constantly updated list of clinical trials is available. We take that a step further to provide contact information and different ways to get involved in the clinical trial. And leave that decision up to the patient because everyone is different and again needs to be treated as such. So whether you want to start by collecting data and making sure that you've taken power within your own journey or get out there and say, I want to participate in the most active way, we're able to provide them with a way to do everything on that spectrum.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the themes that Mito Action has taken hold of and that we're going to focus on going into 2022 is making sure that our community is research ready. So being able to have conversations like this with our pharma partners and Cyclerion coming in and sharing all the details and answering all the questions about their current trial and helping us to provide all of the necessary information so that patients can then take that back to their medical team and make the best decision for them. And having access to records. And then we also have the Mito Action mobile platform. So we're trying to provide this comprehensive ecosystem where all of the pieces that are necessary to have the most successful opportunity to bring these treatments to market is happening. And we're really excited to be working with Allstripes and Cyclerion to continue to push this all forward. Really are grateful to both of your organizations for your commitment to this community.
Kyra, thank you so much for recognizing that. And I think we would be certainly willing to say that the exact same back to the work that Mito Action is doing and being able to empower patients to make their own decisions, to advocate for themselves. But also, you know, we talk a lot about the Mito lifestyle and understanding the individual journey of each Mito patient. You've done a great job in collecting different resources and building this network of connectivity that allows people to get involved where they'd like to. And I think that we all recognize the importance of working together in collaboration within the space. Everyone has to be rowing in the same direction for the boat to move as fast as it can forward toward treatment, a brighter future, and a way forward for patients. And you've done an excellent job in doing that. And we're so grateful for your education and advocacy work as well, because as a company that's working actively with medical records and data sets, it's also important to us that we're advocating for patients and providing them a space to share their story, both as ambassadors or members of the general community. And we have a lot of members on the team and the ambassador team that share routinely and are comfortable doing that and have gotten into a rhythm where they feel empowered to do so. But we're also encouraging those who are looking for ways to share for the first time to go and find a way to inspire others, and certainly happy to accommodate and chat about different ways that we're involving individuals who are finally feeling like they're in a place where not only they're comfortable sharing, but are ready to inspire, whether they mean to or not. Because every story that's shared within the community is so inspirational to others. And whether you realize it or not, you're impacting someone who maybe you haven't met yet, get out of their shell and share their story too.
Absolutely. And it's those stories that encourage and inspire people to get involved. And, you know, hearing stories where patients have successfully participated in a clinical trial will ease a patient's burden and stress in whether they're considering to join a trial like Cyclerion. And so we want to make sure we're continuing to tell those stories. We're continuing to provide the information so that patients are armed to make the best decisions possible for them and their families. So that's really important. So Chad, any last words or any last information that you'd like to share before we go into a little rapid fire here, which is a fun part of our podcast that we like to do that gives our community a chance to get to know our partners and our guests a little bit better?
I think the common thread between Rich and myself and Mito Action is just the importance of clinical research, sharing information, being open, trying to push things along so we can actually bring new treatments to market. I think that's our ultimate goal, and it requires all of us. I think all the work that Rich is doing and all the work that you guys are doing, we can't do it alone. I mean, rare disease drug development is one of the most challenging types of drug development there is, because there's so few patients and there's not a lot known about any of these very rare indications and diseases. So the work that Rich is doing in terms of understanding the natural history, getting patients involved, knowing where they are, informing them that there are these opportunities to get involved in clinical research is extremely important.
Absolutely. And we want to provide a forum where patients feel comfortable to call and reach out to not only Cyclerion or All Stripes, but in Mito Action, and to ask questions. And let's continue to have these conversations so that we can continue to provide a level of comfort, because their participation is critical. And we all know, and that's what we're all here to try and encourage, and make sure that, again, as I said, patients are armed with all the information they need to make the best decision for their family. So, all right, gentlemen, so this is the fun part of the podcast where we do a rapid fire, and I'm just going to ask a couple fun questions to get to know you a little bit better, right? COVID, we've all been stuck inside. Tell me what has been your favorite show to binge watch during COVID.
Oh my goodness. There's so many of them because I feel like I've been quarantining for so long. To binge watch, my wife and I just recently finished White Lotus on HBO and really, really enjoyed that.
Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah,
tell us about the show.
It's a limited series. It's set at a resort in Hawaii, and it's about kind of a set of strangers that have, you know, a lot of money and a lot of privilege, and they are all kind of put together into this resort and interact in different ways. And I don't know, it's just there's really great characters. The music is, I've said, is kind of the glue of the show, and it's very well done, and the soundtrack is great, and it I don't know, it's a nice kind of perspective on privilege and how we think about kind of our vacations and travel, and it was just really, really fun to watch. I thought it was very well done.
I'll have to add that to my list. How about you, Rich?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm so glad you didn't ask me to go first on this one. I have just two answers here, because one is more of, I think, a cop out, and a collection is, we've been inside for so long that it makes it so easy to rewatch all of the Marvel movies. So
yeah,
my partner and I did the full rewatch, and it has led to all of the series that have been coming out on Disney Plus recently, which deal with some heavier topics like grief and purpose. So there are different ways to view what you'd assume are just superhero programs, but just having the time to go through and watch 20-something movies is something we probably wouldn't have been afforded if we weren't stuck inside. But I think more on the positive side, of course, everyone has heard of Ted Lasso and the fact that it's crazy enthusiastic and infectious with positivity for the most part. So that's been a great watch as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that one. We've really enjoyed that as well.
Love it. Well, I have to tell you guys a funny thing. So everyone who knows me, I have a house full of athletes, and the boys in my house, including my husband, like, will not watch musicals. They won't go to musicals. And my daughter and I love musicals. Hamilton has been the hit in my house over COVID. And it's so funny because my 17-year-old son, who is this, you know, mega athlete, he's in the car driving, singing Hamilton to the top of his lungs. And my husband has headphones out mowing the lawn, singing Hamilton. So Hamilton has been the go-to show in our house over COVID, and everyone loved it.
It's so good.
I know. It's just great. It just fills my heart that we have converted them, you know, to musicals, because that's always the category. We do a nightly game of Jeopardy. We're a very competitive family. So when the musicals come on, everyone's like, oh man, mom's going to win it. So now, you know, they're getting into it. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was surprised how great the Hamilton recording was, because you can turn on subtitles, which sometimes you miss a lot of the lyrics because they're so quick. So we really enjoyed watching it that way. I feel like I picked up on a lot more than I would have if we didn't see the lyrics on the bottom of the screen.
Absolutely. Agree with you. You got to have the lyrics. You got to be able to sing it when you watch it. All right. So you're stranded on a desert island, and you can only have one meal for all the time you're on the desert island. What would it be?
Oh, wow. Rich, you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, I need a minute to think on this one. Let's see. Desert island. I think that there's something unique about being in the Bay Area out here, and it is a few different styles of cooking. And I think that one of the things that has been great since making the move over to the Bay Area last year is the different ways in which the communities, and particularly my partner, cooks a tri-tip on the grill. It is wonderful. It's something I didn't experience on the East Coast very much. So whether it is on the grill, or it's a part of tacos or a stew, that's the way to go. And it's something that's very new for me, and it wasn't as available on the East Coast. So I think that's the new desert island meal.
I love it. I love it. How about you, Chad?
thanks for giving me a little time to think about it. I'm originally from the South, from Kentucky, actually. And so I grew up eating a lot of, you know, Southern food, very heavy, very filling, very comforting type food. So I think honestly, when I think about some of my favorite meals as a child, they're often some of the ones that I crave now, especially living in New England that you don't see very often. I think one of them is, it's very basic, but like meatloaf and like mac and cheese and some vegetable side. It's very, like I said, very comforting, something that my parents cooked a lot growing up. And it's hard to get a good meatloaf. Biscuits and gravy is a very close second for me. Also very hard to find in the Northeast.
That's good. Nothing better on a fall day than some comfort food of meatloaf and mac and cheese. I love that. All right. One last one. Tell me what product you are brand loyal to. So it doesn't matter. Like you go to the grocery store and that brand's not on the shelf. You're not switching. You're not buying anything. Like, is it Coke? Is it Tide laundry detergent? What is your brand that you will not waver on?
Well, I can say I had an issue. Does this have to be food or can it be?
It can be anything. It can be anything.
So yeah, so I just had my phone actually just went bad a couple of days ago. So I had to rush to the store to get a new phone. And I've been like, you know, Apple committed for as far as I can remember. And it's just because everything is within that environment in our home, right? It's like, if it's not an Apple product, it can't communicate with other things that I own. And so I'm just like full in there. Like if they have new headphones that come out, I pretty much have to buy it. The HomePods, all of their products, just because that's my ecosystem and that's how they get us. And I actually debated, like, should I switch to Android? Because they have some new phones now that are maybe a little bit more progressive and interesting. And I still decided to get an Apple product. So they got me.
Yeah, there's something about it. You just can't. I agree. There was a big story in the news last night talking about the new drop of the new Apple phone, the new iPhone. And the reporter was saying, look, we're all going nuts over these new drops on iPhones and they're all just the same. But we got to have the latest. We got to have the greatest. They brainwashed us all. We got to have the next phone. Where the Android folks who were on the interview were saying, I've had my phone for 4 or 5 years. It works just fine. My battery's fine, having no issues. But here we are, the Apple users. We got to have the latest and greatest. You're absolutely right. How about you, Rich?
Yeah. So I'm going to keep it out of the grocery store for this one as well. I think that for me, I'm a big casual athlete. And so for as long as I can remember, I have been wearing Brooks running shoes. So it is only Brooks all the time for the last 10 years. And that includes the shoes, the shorts, that it just everything works together. And it is definitely 95% mental. But the idea that when you find a good fit on something that can be very uncomfortable, you don't let it go ever. And I've been wearing similar shoes for the last 10 years to go for a run. And then on the same side of that, to remain active, particularly through the pandemic, I am just obsessively loyal to Peloton. And both the riding and the content they put out for the treadmill has been fantastic. So it keeps me active, keeps me moving, and makes the harder days to get out there and move a little bit easier when someone is doing it with you, even though they're also running with or riding with 50,000 people. So it's been my brand loyalty is usually to athletics, because when you find something that's comfortable, you stick with it.
I love it. We'll have to do a group ride on Peloton, Rich.
Oh, I'll be ready.
They have a Hamilton ride, guys. Maybe we do the Hamilton ride.
I have taken it more than once. And
I have too.
That's an understatement.
It's the only ride I can ride and breathe and sing at the same time. Well, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for being here with me today and sharing all of this incredible information for the MeLoss community. Again, I can't express to you enough how grateful we are for your commitment to the mitochondrial disease community. And I look forward to coming back, continuing this conversation, getting an update on Cyclerion and how the trial is going, and just continuing the conversation to empower our patients and our community so we can get these therapies to market. So I thank you both. I wish you all the best, and we will talk again soon.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Hey, everyone. I have some great news. Energy in Action is launching a new monthly series, Parents as Rare. The amazing Adam Johnson, otherwise known as the Dadvocate over on Twitter, will be your host. Each month, Adam will have guests on who know what it's like to be a parent who has a rare disease and all that goes along with that. I'm excited to share this new series. Make sure you check it out. thank you, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode of Energy in Action. Remember to give us a 5-star rating on your listening app. This helps to boost us up the charts and makes it easier for others to find us. And remember, you can find all of the information referenced either in the show notes or over at mitoaction.org. Thanks for listening and have a great week.